Rider Nation, William Powell, bringing the energy, bringing the fight, bringing the fire every game day, every practice. Let's go, Rider Nation.
I'm ready.
That is the Johnny McKeag Band with Here We Go. This is the Piffles Podcast, your premier Saskatchewan Rough Riders fan podcast. Thanks so much for taking time to give us a listen. I'm Alex.
I'm Steve.
No Greg today because he got shipped back to Winnipeg. Did something again. I don't know what happened. Maybe it was his wife sent him back there or something. I don't know.
But we jumped into the free agent market.
That's right. We got the best of the best joining us this week. Joining us for the whole show. The great Rob Vanstone of the Regina Leader Post and Saskatoon Star Phoenix. Rob, thanks for coming in and doing this.
Oh, thanks so much, Alex. Thanks, Steve. It's a great pleasure to be here.
We have a lot to get to. Obviously, the Riders are on a bye week, but we'll have a preview coming up of the game. The West Final, Riders hosting the Bombers on Sunday. Rob, we're going to talk about your book here in just a little bit, but let's get right down to business here. Give us a follow on Twitter at PifflesPod. You can give me a follow at RealAlexD.
You'll find me at Safamud.
And Rob, where can everybody find you?
Probably the buffet. at Rob Vanstone.
He says that as I haven't eaten supper yet.
I'm going really right after
now.
This.
Well, maybe we'll go together.
I need to get myself back up to 700.
So. Facebook.com/PifflesPodcast. Also on Instagram, just search PifflesPod. Go to the website, PifflesPodcast.com. Piffles Podcast is brought to you by Dairy Queen on Elphinstone Street and Sass Drive in Regina. They're on Skip the Dishes. Make sure you check them out. And also, we're a proud member of the CFPN, the Canadian Football Podcast Network, and a part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Let's get to it. Time for the opening kickoff. Let's start off with the two games that happened this past week, the semifinals, Eskimos at the Alouettes. We'll start there in the East. A game that not a lot of us saw coming. We all kind of picked the Alouettes last week. Eskimos win 37-28. Trevor Harris, record-setting day. I don't think I've ever seen a quarterback play like that in the playoffs before, and that includes his 6th touchdown game. That was last year.
Yeah,
and that was absolutely phenomenal watching him do that.
Yeah, it was an event when there was finally an incompletion. It just, when he gets on one of those rolls, and he can do that, and that's what makes him scary, and that's what, I never thought I would say this, makes Edmonton scary. I remember a game when Ottawa came here last year, and Trevor Harris was just, he couldn't miss. He was throwing these beautiful touch passes right to the sidelines, just right over the defender with the receiver just getting in bounds. And just, he has some of those nights when he's absolute, days even when he's absolutely uncanny. And he might be the wild card in the whole playoff equation. What if Trevor Harris just cannot throw an incompletion even if he tries? That could alter the balance of power everywhere.
Who would have thought going into that game that Trevor Harris would be up for a record like he was? What was it, 22 straight? And that Greg Ellingson, of all people, would let him down?
The Ottawa connection. It's making their way over to Edmonton, and they're doing pretty good. Montreal's defense, on the other hand, they were just invisible, missing tackles, and they just couldn't get anything going.
No, and they Vernon Adams looked like did not perform the way he had performed. He'd gotten them there, and then so much of Montreal's success to this point in the season is attributable to the way Vernon Adams Jr. played. But those interceptions and just the costly turnovers, and it was a real sad way for the season. And you just saw the anguish on the sidelines when he's pounding his fist on the turf at Percival Molson Stadium. He just knew how hard he was taking it, because there's times he has willed that team to victory. And for it to end like that, it was really surprising, because I think there weren't many people picking Edmonton to win. There may have been fewer picking Winnipeg to win.
No, I got to say, you got to give Vernon Adams a huge shout out. A lot of guys would have been stuck in the locker room kind of feeling down after that performance. What does he do? Goes out onto the field and sits there signing hundreds of autographs for fans at the end of the season. That's why he's a great community guy. That's why I love having him in the CFL. Off day, he looked like a rookie quarterback coming into his first real playoff game.
What I liked is at the end, Christian Matt, offensive lineman for the Alouettes, consoled him on the sidelines. You could see, like you said, it's hitting his fist on the ground, but he was very emotional after. He was crying after the game, feeling like he let the team down. And he said, Vernon, you carried us. You got us here. You're a big reason why we are here. No one ever expected us to get this far, especially with how the offseason went in Montreal and everybody was still, you know, this is a dumpster fire team. And to see the O-lineman come up to him and be like, pick your head up. It's good. You're a part of what we're building here. We're building around you. And it really goes to show just how liked Vernon Adams is on his team and in the CFL here. And Montreal has a lot to look forward to.
Sometimes, too, you have to stumble a little bit before you can taste that adversity, adversity, nice wordsmith, before you can figure it out. I look back to the 1988 Rough Riders, and they had made the playoffs in 11 years. Suddenly they make the playoffs, but BC comes here and absolutely thumps them. And as bitterly disappointing as that was, there were a lot of people saying that this is not going to happen to us again. Of course, the Riders win the Grey Cup the next year, but that 88 loss really did not sit well with anybody. A loss isn't going to, but it gnawed at people. You look at the 2007 Grey Cup, and the Riders lost in BC, and Kerry Joseph, when he was up here for the Plaza of Honor festivities this year, said to a few people, after that 06 loss, a lot of the chatter was, okay, remember this, because this isn't going to happen to us next year. And the next year they went back to BC, won the West Final, ultimately won the Grey Cup. Right before the Riders win the Grey Cup in 2013, the year before, they're an 8-10 team that almost goes into Calgary and wins in the opening round. Darian Durant throws 4 touchdown passes, and there's a Marmy Bryant touchdown at the end. Riders shook that off. It bugged them. They added to the nucleus. They won the following year. So if you look, even in 65 when the Riders won the Grey Cup, the year before they go to Winnipeg for the West semifinal. They're down 15-9. Jim Warden is open in the end zone. Ronnie throws the ball toward Jim Warden, and the ball hits the upright. So you can look at the year before each of the Rough Riders Grey Cup victories, and you can see that disappointment and how they were able to rally from it. Maybe Montreal can do the same thing.
Let's hope that is similar, given how we lost out last year and coming up against a game and against the same team we lost to last year. But
that team, the Bombers, going into Calgary, absolutely dominating them in the second half, 35-14 the final score, but it was 14-5 for the Stamps in the second quarter, and Winnipeg went on a 30-0 run the rest of the way. And it kind of, I said this on the show last week, I think if it's going to be as cold as it was for that game, like it was last year for the West semifinal here in Regina, that if it's going to be close, Winnipeg's going to win because they're just going to grind them down in the fourth quarter and run the ball. And that's exactly what they did, and they just took over. I've never seen Bo Levi Mitchell play that poorly ever. It was a bad time for him. I mean, great for us, I guess, if we don't want to see the Stamps go very far. But for him to pick the worst game of his career, it was very ill-timed.
He just looked average. I don't know what Winnipeg did, especially coming out of halftime. He outright said that they were throwing things at him that he's never seen before. For a guy who's been in the league, seven years now?
Yep.
To get that kind of comment after a playoff game shows you just how prepared that Winnipeg defense was. And I can't believe I'm going to do this. Listeners might want to pay attention here. I'm about to say something nice about Chris Streveler.
Whoa.
It's never happened. Dude balled out on a broken foot with torn ligaments. And he looked, as good as he can as a runner. I mean, I won't say anything nice about his passing, but that was a hell of a performance.
I don't know how long was the needle they put in his foot. They must have done something. And you look in Rider history, and George Reed did that in the 67 playoffs. He was basically mummified. He rushed for 204 yards in a playoff game, and his foot was just a mess. He was just a total walking bruise. Remember Wes Cates in 2007 goes into the West Final in BC. The Riders running backs for the West semifinal in 07 were
Josh Ronick and
Corey Holmes.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, Wes Cates comes back for the West Final and had to get his foot numbed. And then, fittingly, it was Wes Cates who got the last first down in the Grey Cup. But what Wes Cates did in 2007, I don't think it's a lot different than what Chris Streveler is doing now. It's just absolute pure guts. And you have to have boundless admiration for what he's doing. That is amazing.
And what Paul Appelese put together on offense with a quarterback who is almost afraid to run in Zach Collaros, and a quarterback who can basically only run in Chris Streveler, what he put together for that game plan, especially in the second half, that was nothing short of masterful.
And you wonder if I talked to Luke Mullender today. He was on our Leader Post Rider Rumblings podcast, and we talked a bit about that. And Luke said, okay, but now they've played that card. Now that card is on the table. They've lost the element of surprise as far as using Chris Streveler like they did. I'm sure there'll be all sorts of little variations of that, given Paul Lapolis's intelligence and pedigree. But that being said, they've played that card. Chris Streveler isn't going to surprise the Riders now. So maybe it works to the Riders' benefit that Winnipeg had to play a game the week before. Then again, I keep throwing all these historical references in, but 1997, the Riders pulled the option quarterback attack on the Calgary Stampeders in the West semifinal, and they had no idea that Reggie Slack was going to come out and do that. And they went into Edmonton the next week and won two, doing a lot of the same things. So Edmonton saw Reggie Slack on film leading up to the 1997 West final, and they weren't able to combat it any more adeptly than the Calgary Stampeders were. So maybe they can squeeze another victory out of that one, but I just don't see it happening. I think the Riders are the better team, and they're going
to
win.
If Winnipeg wants to actually surprise Rider Nation, they might actually get Chris Streveler to complete a pass.
That would be so...
You had to get your shot in there.
I did,
right?
I did. I couldn't leave it with a nice comment. I'm sorry.
I don't know how the Riders are going to combat that. At least, I don't... And we'll talk about this in the preview a little bit later on, but the Riders could potentially have their own two-headed quarterback system. And Rob, you saw that in 1989, especially with the Riders with Tom Burgess and Ken Austin. It was a two-quarterback system, but two quarterbacks that were a little bit more similar than Streveler and Kolaros.
Yeah.
That's so different than what we saw just this past weekend.
Neither one of them was a runner in the case of Austin and Burgess. They could get around a little bit earlier in their career, but none of them was going to give you a bit of the kind of different dimension that Chris Streveler was going to give you. They had their own strengths. One was better against the zone. One was better at beating the blitz. Tom Burgess would absolutely kill you if you tried to blitz him. And if you tried playing zone against Ken Austin, he would lacerate you. And the Hamilton Tiger Cats certainly found that out in 1989. But they're both primarily passing quarterbacks on a team that had an array of great receivers. And Pell Sartori, this offensive genius, making things work as well. So it's a different in this case in that you've got Chris Streveler was in the game for 23 snaps on Sunday and did not throw a pass. That's amazing. So in a way, they're telegraphing what they're going to do. You know that if Chris Streveler is in, they're going to run. But the question then becomes, how are they going to run? Because he was in the game for 23 snaps, carried the ball on 12 of them. But they've also got Andrew Harris. They've also got Nick Dembski that they can throw into the equation. It's almost a bit of a throwback decades ago before either of you were born or perhaps your parents were born, when there was some creativity to how everybody moved around in the backfield, and even the identity of the running back was a result of trickery. And the Bombers are using that indecision to their advantage now. How are they? Yeah, they're going to hand off, but to whom? And which way is he going? And they can use motion to their advantage to considerable effectiveness, as we've seen.
And we saw exactly that with Nick Dembski's touchdown when Streveler was in the game, and they had to combat him going outside, leaving Dembski free to run up the middle for his score. I mean, it's tough to battle against three very different running type threats. I mean, all Chris Streveler is going to do is run at you. He's going to try and run through you. Nick Dembski's going to go around you, and Andrew Harris can do both. It's really hard to defend that, especially when all three are on the field and all three are going at once.
We'll talk a little bit more about the Winnipeg Blue Bombers coming up a little bit later in the show. The opening kickoff presented by Kathy Festian of Roy LePage Regina Realty. Check out her Facebook page, Kathy Festian, Roy LePage. Now, this week's Odds and End Zones by Churchill Brewing Company. Look around the CFL, a couple other stories. And Rob, Daron Carter got released. Is his career over now in the CFL? Is that it?
I don't think so. Talent will always get a chance. And I'm surprised that if they were going to do it, they didn't do it at some point during the year when they could have bought themselves some cap room by doing so, because there really wasn't a lot of productivity there during the year. But I think one of the reasons they kept him around is because of that abundant talent. And next year he'll still only be 29 years old, and in the right situation, as we saw here in 2017, he can absolutely light it up. If a coach can do with Daron Carter what Chris Jones did, and it's still a mystery to me why Chris Jones didn't adopt the same approach in 2018 as he did in 2017. Mm-hmm. I think you can you can go a distance with Daron Carter. I think if Daron Carter has a coach like Craig Dickinson, who you just want to run through a wall for, I'm not espousing that the Rough Riders bring him back, but if that were to be the alliance, I think there's a lot that's salvageable there with Daron Carter.
Well, if you look at him this year, he wasn't as big of a liability off the field. Yeah, he still ran his mouth on Twitter. He's entertaining. He's a self-proclaimed troll. But beyond that, there was no real big stories. There was no fights at practice. There was no criminal issues. There was nothing like that. He just wasn't getting it done on the field. And to me, that's the scarier part. Did the talent drop off, or were they just not using him right?
The big question around him, though, is does that one guy on Twitter have to kiss his ass? Does he have to join the Daron Carter Kiss My Butt Club? I don't know if you saw this.
I'm not familiar with that one.
So before the season started, some guy said, I'll bet you to Daron Carter that you won't finish the season on a CFL roster or the BC Lions roster. And he said, if I get it right, you got to buy me tickets to Grey Cup. And so Daron's like, okay, fine. Getting Grey Cup tickets is easy. I can do that for you. I want you to literally kiss my butt. And you're a big wrestling fan. You remember the old Vince McMahon kiss my ass club, right?
So defined season, though.
Yeah.
The Lions season is over, but the CFL season is not yet concluded.
So that's where the big semantics debate lies, right? So should this guy have to join the club?
Or does Daron owe tickets?
Yeah.
I would think so.
A little bit of both. Bring him out to Grey Cup, Daron. Bring him out there, and Daron goes there, and they do something. I don't know if I really want to see that, but
at least take him to a movie like he did with the Rider fans in 2017. Daron's basically a harmless, fun person.
He is. He really is.
I really enjoyed the time that he was here and watching him play. The Riders got the absolute best out of Daron Carter. Yeah, there was that imbroglio at practice with Sam Williams, but for the most part, They got so much out of Daron Carter that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following year, it seems like they were determined not to use that weapon to their advantage. Well, it was just a strange situation. Or maybe that's the shelf life. Maybe 1 year plus seven games is about all you're going to get out of him with anything approaching maximum effectiveness. The Riders extracted as much as they could.
I dare you to find somebody in the CFL right now that loves life as much as he does, though.
John Rush.
No, he loves dogs more than he loves
Cody Fajardo.
Yeah. There you go.
Speaking of Fajardo, named Player of the Year finalist against Brandon Banks out of Hamilton in the end. As for the Riders, up for the awards, Cody Fajardo, Cameron Judge for Canadian, and Craig Dickinson for Coach of the Year. Do you guys see either any one of those three winning their award?
I'd say Cameron Judge is the only one that has a legitimate shot at this point.
Henoc Buamba's got the bigger name and the bigger reputation. I think if you look at plays that have been impactful and highlight real plays, Cameron Judge has had the better year, but Henoc Buamba is, I think, the more recognizable name. That's the one that I think, I think the Riders might have the best shot there. I think there's a very good case for Cody Fajardo, and I don't think there's a lot of people who agree with me.
I've been arguing right along with you on that one on Twitter.
Well, let's try and make this case, Steve. Like, I think if you have to look at degree of difficulty, what he does as a quarterback carries more weight than, with all due respect to Brandon Banks, what is done as a receiver. What he's done for this franchise, you take Cody Fajardo away from the Saskatchewan Roughriders, and you're talking a pretty good draft pick next year. What the transformative effect he has had on this team. An all-star quarterback in the West Division when their quarterback goes down three games into the year. I only threw 18 touchdown passes. Ron Lancaster threw 16 touchdown passes in 1970 and was named the league's most outstanding player. So, I only threw for a shade over 4,302 yards, which is a low total for a league passing yardage leader. But Kerry Joseph was just over 4,000 in 2007.
And
was named most outstanding player. And Brandon Banks had 1,550 receiving yards. But so what? Joey Walters had 1,715 in 1981, and he didn't win most outstanding player.
When you look back,
and Joey deserved it. I love Joey Walters.
And his name's actually going to come up a little bit later in the show here.
The argument that a lot of Hamilton fans try to make is he led the league in passing. He was far and away the league leader. Well, no, he beat Burnham by, 28 yards. And 1,550 yards is not an exceptional season anymore. It was 5 years ago, but it would not have finished first in any year since 2015. Yes, he had 13 touchdowns. That's a solid year as a receiver, but so is 600 rushing yards and 10 rushing touchdowns, and only two of them were sneaks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the design that went into the Cody Fajardo touchdown runs, it wasn't like a James Franklin 14 touchdown runs last season, average gain per touchdown 1 yard. I mean, Cody Fajardo was a weapon along the ground. I don't think you can conveniently subtract the touchdown runs from the equation. And I don't think this argument is going to really be that successful. I think Brandon Banks will probably win pretty handily, but I think there's a really good case for Cody Fajardo. I'm not sure that Craig Dickinson is as fortunate. If you look at 15-3 and Craig Dickinson lost his starting quarterback, well, so did Orlando Steinauer.
And what Dane Evans did there was what Dane Evans did there. Awesome.
Not only that, they're 15-3. They got to play 10 of their games against the West. So it's not,
and they were 8-2 in those games.
Yeah.
One of them was lost on a blocked field goal by the Calgary Stampeders, and the other one was on Fajardo's last second touchdown rush. So they very easily could have won both of those games and been 17-1, and still nobody's talking about them.
Yeah. And so I think you're of the awards that we're discussing, I think the East probably wins all of them. But I don't know. Cody Fajardo, I think, is the best story in the Canadian Football League this year.
Did Charleston Hughes get snubbed? Should he have been the Defensive Player of the Year for the West over Willie Jefferson?
No, I think they got that one right. The stats are there for Hughes to beat him, but I just see Willie Jefferson as having been more impactful as a player throughout the game. Defenses had to work around Willie Jefferson. Or offenses, sorry, had to work around Willie Jefferson. I don't feel like they really game planned as much for Charleston Hughes.
Although, I mean, there certainly were double teams, and he did lead the league in sacks, and he had twice as many tackles as Willie Jefferson. And I go back to the Rough Riders Bombers' most recent game, and granted, it's a snapshot of the season, but after every game, I go home and rewatch the game on the PVR and do some sort of statistical tallies that interest absolutely nobody except my mother. And so I rewatched that game and took note of various things, quarterback pressures, all this. And then I thought, did Willie Jefferson get hurt? Where was he? So I did play from beginning and watched again and took note of, was Willie in the game? If so, what did he do? He was in the game for, I think, 81.2% of the plays. Nothing. He did absolutely nothing.
There was no tackles. No,
he did
anything.
Not appear on the stat sheet.
Yeah.
So he kind of hit the skids toward the final third of the year. And so did Charleston Hughes for the most part. He went, I think, 4 games without a sack. But in that last game against Edmonton, the one that they have to win to get first place, he had a sack. And not only that, he tipped a pass that was intercepted by Cameron Judge and returned for a touchdown. And you look at the multi-sack games that Charleston Hughes has had over the years, and I think his body of work has got to count for something. Willie Jefferson's been around for a few years and has been extremely good. But it's almost... he almost deserves a lifetime achievement award for what he's done. I mean, leading the league in sacks for 4 consecutive years at ages 32, 33, 34, 35.
That's incredible.
That's amazing.
Well, let's move on to a couple questions, and we got them for you, Rob, as well, too. This is for Underdogs Memorabilia. If the Riders win the Grey Cup this year, is this the most talented Riders team of all time? I say no. I think the 89 team, when you look at top to bottom, who was on that roster, and you look at the all-time greats who were on that roster, there's just way more all-time greats on that 89 team than there is on this team right now.
If you look at that team, it's at the time, it seemed like a fluke that they beat Edmonton and went on to win the Grey Cup. But if you look at that personnel, and you look at Jeff Fairholm and Ray Algard, both Canadians playing slot back with James Ellingson backing them up. And I mean, that team was absolutely amazing. I look at that 2004 team that didn't win, and I think that's about as talented a Rider team as I've ever seen. Roy Shivers put together an amazing, amazing team. That just was, it's amazing that team didn't get to the Grey Cup. Some of those teams in the 60s that didn't win, NFL Films did a series a few years ago on missing rings and just great NFL teams that didn't win Super Bowls. And I think you could almost do missing rings equivalents for the Rough Riders. You look at 67 through 1970 inclusive. The 14-2 Rider team that didn't get to the Grey Cup. Some of those post-1966 teams that you look everywhere and basically anybody who was a starter is in the Plaza of Honor. Many are in the Hall of Fame, and they didn't win Grey Cups. But I don't know why, for some reason, that 2004 team, I just look at that and think, geez, that team could have won because it was absolutely loaded everywhere. They built such a great team. and then misfortune befalls them.
I think we're a little early into a lot of the careers for some of the talented players on this roster to really even think of them as being in that most talented conversation yet. May they be when you look back on it? Possibly, but we're talking about a lot of young guys on this roster. I just don't see it yet.
What they are is deep, and there's a lot of resumes that have yet to be completed. How good is Shaq Evans going to be? How many 1,000-yard seasons is he going to have? We still don't know, but there will be multiple seasons of that description, barring unforeseen events. But I think leading up to the trade deadline this year, and the Riders, I think, underline this by not making any moves, you look at that team, and where is a flaw? If a couple of injuries hit, nobody's going to be able to withstand that at this time of the year.
You could say that for any team, though.
For any team. But if you look at the depth that the Riders had, and really had to look at it around the time of the trade deadline, I'm not sure it's the most talented team they've ever had, but especially in a salary cap era, to have the kind of depth that they are blessed with, when you consider that their quarterback is hurt three plays into the year, when you consider all the flux on the offensive line, Brendan Labatt not playing for the first two-thirds of the season, what happened with Dan Clark, Dakota Shepley stepping in like he did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Overall, they haven't been especially beset by injuries this year, but when they have been, people have stepped up, and I think the depth of this team is a major reason for its excellence.
Now, I know I can speak for Steve and myself here. We took a lot of delight in watching the Calgary Stampeders implode this past weekend, but it brought a really good question because a lot of Stamps fans were saying, well, just watch what you wish for. Just wait till next week, till Winnipeg gets there. Maybe you guys won't be so cocky and everything then. But would you rather see another team lose, such as the Stampeders, or watch your team win, the Riders? So, and you're wearing a Denver Broncos hat matching me right now. Would you rather see, I mean, obviously our team's not going to win the Super Bowl this year, but would you like to rather see the Chiefs lose?
Oh, yeah.
Or watch the Broncos win?
At this time of year, you want the Broncos to get a better draft pick, and you want everything to happen to the Chiefs, especially the Raiders. So, at this point, of the year with the Broncos season being lost, you just get vindictive and petty. I don't hide from that. In fact, I relish it.
And I'm kind of the same way. You look at the success the Stampeders have had over the last 15 years. It's been unbelievable. They've missed the West Final twice since 2008. That's an incredible stat. I think to me, watching them lose was more satisfying because it makes the last three games of the season just that little bit extra. There's that little bit of excitement because they're not there, and there's a wide open spot now because you just expect the Calgary Stampeders to be the Western Grey Cup nominee. It's just how it's been.
And yeah, a lot of it has to do with jealousy. I mean, we'd love for our team to be in how many, 10 out of 12 West Finals. Like, we'd love to see the Riders there every single year. Obviously, it's not going to happen. But yeah, that's a little bit of jealousy. And like you said, pettiness
is a wonderful thing.
I'm on board with that too. I love seeing teams that I don't really like. I got to say, I respect what the Stampeders have done. It's like the New England Patriots. I'm not even mad at the New England Patriots win anymore. It's just like, wow, we're watching something special with them. And I say that about the Stamps as well, too. But when they lose, it's just, just that much better.
I always feel bad for Mark Mueller, grandson of Rider royalty. And I'm old enough to remember John Huffnagel quarterbacking the Rough Riders and even assistant coaching with the Rough Riders. So there's that. And Dave Dickinson's a tremendous person. So they're not the same Stampeders that used to. They had some teams in the, maybe a decade ago that really seemed to strut and they had a swagger before they'd really earned it. And you look at the 2010 West Final, you look at the 2013 West Final, I think those teams just thought that they were going to waltz into the Grey Cup, and they're the Stampeders. And they had an attitude, and they never really backed it up with performance when it came down to a critical situation. And the Stampeders had largely dispelled that reputation. And that's what made the game on Sunday surprising, because it wasn't a matter of the Stampeders being overconfident, as they were wont to do, I think, in previous years. I just think they got outplayed and they got their butts kicked at home. Mm-hmm. And that, I could have seen a closer game unfolding and maybe understood it a bit more, but 30 consecutive points, that was just so shocking. I don't think anybody can figure it out, and I think a lot of those people reside in Calgary.
Well, moving on here. Once again, Steve, you do have, you've searched high and low on Twitter to find something that just made you, whether it was laugh or happy. The CFL tweet of the week. Who gets honored this week here on the Piffles podcast?
You know what? And I did it last week and I'm doing it again this week. Well, no, last week was at least CFL themed. This one is not at all. And I'm going to take a little bit of flack for highlighting this one, given the topics of today. It's also our very first double winner. The tweet of the week goes out to Krista again. And if you've been paying attention to the news, you'll understand why this one was good. Don Cherry is a lot like Tim Hortons. People have been tricked into thinking it's ultra-Canadian, so they keep going back out of habit, even though 90% of what they have to offer is stale and gross. I don't remember the last time I read a tweet and actually howled at it. And that was
perfectly because you had
timed.
The Tim Hortons coffee beside
right,
you?
It absolutely was. I go for a tea at Tim's every day.
Their chili is so good. I love the Tim Hortons chili.
I don't know the last time I've had muffins there, and I regret it every time, but it's just they're convenient. They're everywhere. But, oh, I sat there drinking my tea and just broke out laughing. So if you don't follow her, you need to. It's, what is it, Krista_B_85, something like that?
She's a great follow.
Yeah. So there you go, our first double winner. One of these days I'll pick a real CFL-themed tweet again.
The check is in the mail, Krista. But the real reason, Rob, why we did bring you on here is your new book that just came out last week, 100 Things Rough Riders Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. What's one thing in here that you think, just kind of above anything else, Rough Rider fans should know about their team before they die?
One thing they should know. You know what I found really interesting? And this might be a bit obscure and a bit nerdy, but that's me. I never knew this, but their first game was actually played in Regina. It's played in Moose Jaw.
Really?
At the Moose Jaw, what was then known in 1910 as the Moose Jaw Baseball Grounds. It's now part of Crescent Park, near where the Moose Jaw Public Library is now. So this past summer, I took a pilgrimage, or made a pilgrimage to Moose Jaw with Mark Melnichuk, one of our videographers. We went up there and did a video, and it was so cool to stand on this very spot where the Moose Jaw Tigers beat the Regina Rugby Club on October 1st, 1910. So I thought that was cool. I don't know how many times you've driven down Broad Street by the Value Village Mall.
Mm-hmm.
And the Value Village parking lot is where they played their first home game in October of 1910 against Moose Jaw again. And I didn't know this, but they've actually got monuments on Broad Street.
Yeah.
Talking about... showing details and photos from the team's past. Even if you go inside the mall itself, there's a display.
Those are relatively recent too.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I had no idea how long they'd been there. And
a couple years, I think.
Yeah.
I strongly suggest going to Value Village and checking out one of the really cool places in Rider history. I had never done that until my 20th wedding anniversary. My wife and I on May 15th.
What a date, Rob.
We were going to go for a walk in the park, and it was kind of a lousy night out. It just wasn't very nice. We took about two steps around to begin our trek around the lake, scared a duck, and decided we're going to go somewhere else. And what do we do now? So we went to Value Village for our 20th wedding anniversary, and we looked at monuments on the sidewalk, and then we walked inside, and then we went to the Southland Mall food court for our anniversary dinner, and I treated her to a booster juice for dessert. So I just found that was so much fun doing that, just thinking, my goodness, this all happened here on the corner of Broad and 7th Avenue. So that's my, that's number one. Another thing I thought would be really cool to do, and I haven't done it yet, is go to a Rider game everywhere they could possibly play. And there's still a few that I haven't crossed off the list. And I'd love to see a game in Montreal. I have not yet done that except for Grey Cups at Olympic Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And see a game at the new stadium in Hamilton, see a game at the new stadium in Winnipeg. Seeing a Rider game on the road is a really unique thing. And I recommend that for anybody. In fact, there may be a lot of Rider fans traveling to Calgary very soon. So
Montreal should be at the very top of your next visit list.
Yeah.
Easily the best stadium that I've been to in the CFL.
I've only walked by it. I've never actually been there. There used to be a jazz club by there called Biddle's Jazz and Ribs. And so I went there and OD'd on some jazz and walked by the stadium and thought, man, it would really be cool to go in there and see a football game. And I still haven't done that. I guess I better get on it.
I've been there once. I went there for the regular season game in 2008. The Riders, I think it was 35-1. They got absolutely destroyed. Oh. Neil Hughes was the starting running back that game because they ran into so many injuries. with all the broken legs, and Wes Cates was out that year, and it was, it's a good thing the fans around there is just having such a great time. They're there for a party that it was, it just erased.
Isn't
what
Montreal
the game was.
Fun?
It's the best city to go to in Canada for a road game.
We went to, my wife and I went to Toronto where her parents and her family lives, and we went to a Leafs game on a Saturday, and then a couple of nights on a Monday, we went to a Canadiens home game. And I could not believe the difference. We were sitting in the upper deck at the Bell Center, and the fans are singing. They're having the greatest time. We're all the Leafs fans sat there acting like they were performing a tax audit. The sense of fun that Montreal has with regard to everything. And I was lucky enough to go there in 89 for the Jazz Festival too, which was a great event in my life. And Montreal is just an absolute gas. So if you can get to Montreal and go to a game, I still got to do that. That's very high on the list.
How long did this book take you to write?
Oh, goodness. A lot of 3-hour increments. I started writing it in the spring of 2018. Around May or June, and alongside the same time I did a bunch of interviews for it. And the manuscript was due February 1st of this past year. So what's that? 7 or 8 months. But it never really stopped. I had most of it locked down by January, but of course we all know how eventful January was in Ryderville. So suddenly the Chris Jones chapter 82, had to be rewritten with a new ending. And suddenly, okay, I guess I better do a section on Jeremy O'Day, who then hires Craig Dickinson, who also warranted some space. And then I thought I had it pretty much locked down, and then the writer signed John Ryan. So I'm begging the publisher several months after deadline, can I add this chapter? So, and then finally 2 days before public, it went to the presses in Chicago in August. I was able to get a late revision in on the game in Montreal that was shortened by the storm, because there was a parallel to that in 1954 when the Riders went to BC. And I'd already mentioned that in the book under a chapter that was imaginably called Goofy Games in Rider History. So I was able to, I guess overall, from the first time I opened a Microsoft Word file to the final time I annoyed the publisher, it was about 15 or 16 months. But it was weird because I kind of pecked away at it. It was like, do a chapter a day. And it wasn't a linear writing process or a chronological one, unlike the 66 book or the 89 book, where you're kind of just following a path. But here, I think I wrote the Ray Algard chapter, which was chapter 81, before I wrote chapter 6. And there's so many entry points. That was a really weird part about the writing process, was that it wasn't really that orderly. There were several things that I did before I wrote chapter 1. I hope I wrote chapter 1. Let me just check.
Yeah, it's in there.
2013 Grey Cup. So that was a really long-winded, I probably wrote chapters in less time than it took me to answer that question. I do apologize.
So how many chapters didn't make the cut? Is there going to be a second book, the 101 to 200 things a writer fan should do?
I would love that. If it sells well enough and there's another printing, I think there's a case for some alterations. I think there's got to be some Cody Fajardo material in there. I mean, a lot of the book as it stands now could be outdated in 2 weeks, because I've written about 4 Grey Cup victories. They all get a chapter, but they could have 5 very, very soon, and that would certainly be the impetus for a revision if sales warrant. So I initially had a list of about 150, and that was the first night that I said yes, at which point my wife was wondering, why did I ever say yes to him? And I got about 150, and then they told me I could do 100 chapters and about 10 to 20 little sidebars or little color pieces, like shorter chunks. So I ended up with 100 chapters and 20 little sidebars. So there were about 30 that didn't make the cut. And then fortunately, you know, post-script, I haven't had too many causes to think, you know, okay, I should have included that. You can't have, I wish Cody Fajardo was in the book, but when the book goes to press in August, there's not a lot you can do because he isn't yet this phenomenon. You know, given the events of the last couple of months, it certainly led me to think, if I ever have an opportunity to kind of revise this, I think there's going to be some material here.
Is there one particular chapter that you cut and it took you a long time to go, no, that's the one that doesn't make it? Or is there one that you really wanted to get in there that didn't make the cut?
No, that was the good part of it. Nothing that really gnawed at me. They gave me the luxury of doing these little sidebars. So anything that really, really, really I felt should be in there, got in there. I haven't had any writer's remorse yet. the apprehension now is that now that it's written, I just don't want to look at it because all I'm going to do is try and copy edit it again. Right? It's a mind game you play. I just can't read it for pleasure because I'm going to be thinking, should I have phrased this differently or should I? That process never ends. So I kind of flip through it really quickly and look at the pictures. And there's 10 pictures in there. It's the pictorial aspect of it is the highlight for me now.
Now, as I said, we mentioned his name a little bit later on in the show, and this is later on the show now. Chapter 17.
Joey.
Is Joey Walters your favorite rider of all time?
He's one of my favorite people of all time. Unquestionably my favorite rough rider of all time, my favorite athlete of all time. Just an absolutely sensationally nice person. And I always liked him as a player. And I was this 15-year-old kid. I bought a rider jersey at the start of the 79 season, not really expecting to go 2-14. And Ronnie had just retired, so I needed a new rider jersey. And okay, so there's no more. I guess I could keep wearing the number 23 jersey, but I wanted a rider jersey with a player's number on it. So I bought this rider jersey and, okay, what number do I put on there? Okay, 17 Walters I put on the back. And then the first regular season game of 79, he got hurt and didn't play again until October of that year. So I was questioning that decision, but that year he ended up catching 772 yards worth of passes in 6 games. Just extraordinary. And in winter of 81, Joey stayed here for the winter. He just did community appearances on behalf of the team, played on a basketball team. And his dad actually went to high school at Wilson High School in Florence, South Carolina, and was a teammate of Darian Durant's father in high school.
Oh, wow.
Joey was a really good basketball player. He initially had thought he was going to be a basketball was going to be it for him because he was 5'10" and he could dunk. He was just an amazing athlete. And, I saw it advertised somewhere that he was going to be doing a public appearance at the Golden Mile Shopping Center, which wasn't far away from it was within walking distance of my house. So I drove and, I walked and, it was by the old, what was it, crap, the Met store. There was an ice cream stand in the Golden Mile Shopping Center, and Joey Walters was just standing there by himself. And I walked over, introduced myself, and talked to him for 45 minutes. Just shot the breeze with Joey Walters. And afterwards, he apologized for taking up so much of my time. And I just could not believe it. He felt sincerely bad that he felt he had consumed 45 minutes of my time. And I'm talking to this amazingly nice guy. And he went on that year to catch 91 passes for 1,715 yards and 14 touchdowns and was stopped 4 times at the 1-yard line. And I got to know him. In 1990, he came back up for the Plaza of Honor. And I got a chance to sit down and do a story on him. And we became very friendly at that point. We stayed in touch. And I could fill 88 podcasts with what a nice person Joey Walters is. I hope any rider fan who is never had a chance to meet him. I hope you take advantage of the opportunity should it arise, because he's just an absolute 100% sensational person. And he was a pretty good football player, the most spectacular receiver I've ever seen. That's my Joey Walters campaign.
We could probably have you on for another 99 podcasts talking about this book, 100 Things Rough Riders Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Rob, obviously available at Chapters, Indigo.
My trunk.
Your trunk. So if you see Rob in the drive-thru or standing at the buffet, you said you're going to the buffet. If you catch him at the buffet, make sure you stop Rob and get one of these books. This is going to be great. We actually have one to give away as well, too. So watch our social media for that, Twitter and Facebook as well. We'll give away a copy of this book. Rob, before we do let you go here, we're going to talk a little bit about this Bombers game coming up here.
Sure, yeah.
In our
Joey Walters used to be a Bomber, by the way. Number 73 for the Bombers in 1977 before he came to Saskatchewan.
Well, see, he smartened up and got it right, right?
The Bombers messed that one up big time.
So our Tallgrass Apparel enemy preview, we talked about the two-headed quarterback that Winnipeg has. Do you expect, if Cody Fajardo does not play this game, do you expect the Riders to kind of employ their own two-quarterback system with Isaac Harker and Brian Bennett?
Maybe they can, but I don't think they have the enough oomph for the passing attack. Winnipeg is tough to throw against anyway, but they need Cody Fajardo or at least 80% of him, I think, to be successful against Winnipeg. That's a tough defense, and there's been so much talk about the Bomber quarterbacking, but with the Rough Riders heading into practice this week, I think the angle is soon going to change to the health of the Rough Rider quarterback. If Cody Fajardo can't look like Cody Fajardo, that could change everything. I'm just not sure the Riders can go in there with Isaac Harker again and win. Like, he's right out of college. You don't see that very often.
And what he did against time college either.
No, what he did against Edmonton was amazing. But is that just too much of an ask for him to do that against a team that is trying to get to a Grey Cup and a team that, unlike Edmonton on November 2nd, isn't resting a bunch of starters? That is the fear, is that Cody Fajardo can't play like Cody Fajardo has to play. Because it's not the same tier of quarterbacking if you're talking Harker and some Brian Bennett as opposed to Chris Streveler and Zach Kolaros. And in a game of this importance, when you're talking about position of that importance, that could tip it.
The thing that scares me most about the potential for an Isaac Harker start is we saw him against Edmonton, and almost everything he threw was 5, 6, 7 yards downfield or closer. He wasn't doing it. There was no real deep threat like you get with Cody Fajardo and Shaq Evans especially. They didn't seem to have that same chemistry, and obviously his first start, they're not going to have it. That scares me. You cannot be that one-dimensional against a quality defense like the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, because all they have to do now is stop William Powell, because Isaac Harker isn't going to beat you through the air.
Yeah, I will point out that early in the first quarter, Shaq Evans opened down the left sideline, and I'm not sure if that was a slight overthrow or a pass that Shaq Evans ordinarily would have caught, but he was open. The pass was pretty close. And you look at that pass that Isaac Harker threw to Justin McInnes when Edmonton sent everybody. And he got that pass off right before he got cranked, and wasn't an amazing throw by any stretch of the imagination, but he got it to where the receiver to where it had to be for Justin McInnes to make the catch. And if they don't make that play in the face of a real, torrential blitz, maybe they're not a first place football team. So yeah, he wasn't especially proficient on the downfield throws, but that one to Shaq Evans, I still think that's a play that Shaq Evans is going to make more than he doesn't make it. And that throw to Justin McInnes, considering the pressure he was facing, was phenomenal.
Two quick things before we do have to get going here this week. Who's the X factor in this game for the Riders, Steve?
I mean, besides Cody Fajardo, I think it's William Powell. They need to ride him like they haven't been this season. I think they've been keeping him rested, and he's ready to go. You bust him out against a Winnipeg defense and make them respect the run, and it opens everything up. Rob?
Micah Johnson can have such a detrimental effect on what Winnipeg wants to do with the running game. And that's why they signed him to the type of contract they did. They signed William Powell as a free agent, made that as a priority very quickly. But the other major priority on that day, aside from all the chatter about the quarterbacking, was Micah Johnson. And if Micah Johnson can, from an interior line position, can just disrupt whatever the Bombers want to do, he could take over again. There's been so much talk about Charleston Hughes or Willie Jefferson. This is the time for Micah Johnson to have the type of game that he has had repeatedly in the past and absolutely has to have on Sunday.
Well, they thought Micah Johnson was good enough to let a guy like Willie Jefferson go. I agree with you.
As an extension to that, I'm going to go with Solomon Elamimian, just because he's going to have to watch Harris and Streveler as well whenever Streveler comes into the game too. So he's going to have a lot of different assignments in this game. So I'm really intrigued to see how that works out. And finally, our pick'em this week, we'll start in the East, Edmonton at Hamilton.
You're asking me. My predictions were 0-2 last week and could not have been more wrong. I'm going to pick Hamilton. Just 15-3. At home, and given the overall excellence of that team, I can't see that happening. But again, put an asterisk beside any prediction that I hazard at this point in the year.
Same thing. I got to go Hamilton. That team is too good to lose to the Edmonton Eskimos.
Bye week won't hurt them. Orlando will have them ready to go. Hamilton will win that game. And of course, the West final, Winnipeg at Saskatchewan. Steve?
I got to go Riders. Nothing about Winnipeg scares me outside of, pretty much everything. But no, it's going to be the Riders. And I think, and I do this regularly, double digits.
I think if what you've got to do to get to Grey Cup is defeat a quarterbacking tandem of Zach Kolaros and Chris Streveler, with all due acknowledgement of what they did this past weekend, if that's the hurdle you have to clear to get to Grey Cup, I don't think you're talking about having to really scale a particularly formidable wall here. So, again, the variable is Cody Fajardo's health. But all things being equal, the Rough Riders should win this game. And it shouldn't be that interesting by the fourth quarter.
I hope you're both right on that. I have just this weird feeling about this game that it's going to end up being a Grey Cup battle of the droughts. But I'm reluctantly seeing the Riders by, I don't want to say it, but another walk-off field goal. And everyone's going to be chewing on their nails the entire fourth quarter, and it's going to come down to a big kick for a guy who missed four kicks his last game. And I think he's going to be absolutely money. Brett Lawther, of course, getting that game-winning one to send us to the field goal, or sending us to the Grey Cup. I think that would be just kind of a fitting story to kind of wrap up the season going into the Grey Cup. But Rob, thank you so much for coming in, co-hosting with us this week.
Thank you so much for having me. Sorry for my croaky bronchitis voice.
Well, it's no better or no worse than what everybody hears every week with us anyway. So thanks so much for coming in. Of course, the book, 100 Things Rough Riders Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Make sure you go out and get a copy of this, because this is a wonderful book. And Rob, I can't wait. I haven't read it all yet. I have gone through a couple chapters, and I can't wait to sit down and read the whole thing. So it's
I haven't read it yet either, so let me know if I should.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to chat with you guys.
Again, this is the Piffles Podcast. You can check us out on Twitter at Piffles Pod. You can follow me at RealAlexD.
Find me at Safamud.
And Rob, of course, at Rob Vanstone.
At Rob Vanstone.
Very original name, Rob.
Yeah, it's so much creativity.
Piffles Podcast, of course, brought to you by our great friends at Dairy Queen on Elphinstone Street and Sass Drive in Regina. Special thanks as well to Kathy Festian of Royal LePage Regina Realty, Tallgrass Apparel, Churchill Brewing Company, and Underdogs Memorabilia for their support to make this show possible. Piffles Podcast is a proud member of the CFPN, the Canadian Football Podcast Network, and a part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Here's some local talent for you. This is Tyler Gilbert, Ghost Behind Your Mind.